meeting this morning is a continuation of an engagement that we've been having at least for 2 years. And hopefully after today's engagement, the Standing Committee of Public Accounts will be in a position to make a recommendation to Parliament and hopefully close this chapter of our life. So before we begin, can we ask our visitors to just introduce themselves? And thereafter we get introductions from members of Parliament. And we move on. So I am in possession of a piece of paper that says there are three in attendance from De Beers Consolidated Bank. I see more than three people. I'm not going to take the risk and even name them. So if we could start with this gentleman immediately alongside and show me if you could just introduce yourself and you get on with the rest of the talk. Sorry, can you put your mic on for recording purposes, please?
Massimo Nonella from South African Diamond and Shaft Lighting Regulator.
And from Andy Chikani, former chairman of the South African Diamond Board.
The chairman of the Department of the London.
The other side, Mr. Kumede.
John Kumede, member of school.
Henry Schmidt, member of the Mineral Energy Committee.
Eddie Trent, Kaza.
Barney Killer Pule, Kopa.
John Bola Samuana, Kopa.
Avaran Kukumu Kopa.
Thank you very much, AG's office.
Morning, Chair Wally from Yemen from the Olympic General.
Mr. Martin Gordon, National Treasury Tax Commission.
And to our friends from the media, you're welcome. Also, the support staff for both the committee and the AG's office, you are all welcome to the meeting, and we formally then start with the proceedings. And also, the chairperson of the committee is coming today. I'm sure that during the proceedings he will join us in the meeting. I trust all is in order. We, ladies and gentlemen, have got an hour and a half to deliberate on the De Beers matter. By 11 o'clock we should be concluded with our meeting. So I'm going to be a little bit ruthless in the event of members dragging on. We're going to ask pointed questions and we would expect pointed answers. So I'm going to ask members of Parliament not to unnecessarily give us a thesis before you put your question, and similarly from the department, that as far as is humanly possible, just give us an answer so that we can formulate a response to Parliament in terms of the evidence that is given to us before, during the course of this meeting. So we want to start off, I assume, Mr. Faber, that you will be first person to start the proceedings,
or
have
you
guys got somebody else that you want to start?
Just to put in context, of course we have new members here and might be some benefits. The reason we are sitting here today, Chair, 20 million tariffs on uncut diamonds, worth a value of about $900 million. The levy, tax levy in there, that to be about $135 million, which works out to about $1 billion tax. Out of the country without paying the tax, saying that they had an admission from the diamond board, the then diamond board. In terms of that submission, which comes from the 1986 Act. And when that Act was passed in Parliament, I think it was to the benefit of all the members to actually understand what the reason was for a new Act in 1986, because there's been Act since 1960 on the whole issue of diamonds. And the reason for that is, and I'll, if you allow me, I'd like to quote the then Minister Diamond saying of the he said here, the prime objectives of this bill are to rationalize existing legislation relating to control of the diamond industry of the RSA and to establish a more effective control structure in the diamond industry. It is a fact that this is an industry that lends itself to suspicion and malpractices, and it is for this reason that over the past 13 years the government has found it necessary to order no fewer than 3 formal and informal investigations into one facet or another of the diamond industry. Certain highlighted areas were highlighted. One such problem area is divided control amongst department institutions, uncoordinated government decision making and action committee, 3 state departments are involved, etc. Chair, now, we're sitting here today for 15 years. We've raised this issue in Parliament since 1999. COPA has raised this issue. It's been in the media. It's been raised in Parliament. It was raised by various ministers, various departments. And nowhere has the bill come to the party and say, look, here is our permission for the export of these diamonds in 1992. Only when we asked them to come here, did they produce their documents to the age? Now, I'd like to ask a question. On that document that Beers produced, which they say is their agreement that they have in terms of the 1998 permission to take diamonds out of the country without trade tax. Now, I take it that Beers, the gentleman of Beers, have this agreement with the 1998.
Are we familiar with the document that Mr. Herr was talking about? Even if you don't have it with us here, but are we familiar with the document?
I did not familiar with it. Should we chair and taking a copy of it?
Thanks. Continue, Mr. Herr.
I'd like to ask my question when you've got the document in your hand.
It's fine?
That's terrifying. The document, it is, in terms of the Diamond Act, number 56 of 1986, the Unification Diamond Board is the consolidated Diamond Limited, and it's apparently the document that is signed on the back page.
Yes, that's the fine in January and Johannesburg, I think in March, 19th of March,
1993.
Am I correct? Now this document, and I have to say, being a copy of a document on it, it's not really very, very in a good condition. But I'd like to ask you, if you've got the document, this is a 1998 document. Who signed on behalf of De Beers Consolidated Mines on this document? I can't make up the name.
I'm not sure if it's the two signatures on my copy. I'm not sure if it's the second signature, but the first one is clearly Gary Ray, who was the managing director of De Beers Consolidated Mines.
Right, so Mr. Gary Ray has signed this document, plus another gentleman from yourself. And then there was someone from the Diamond Board. Do you know who that person was? Maybe this person, the Diamond Board.
I'm afraid I'm not in a position to identify the Diamond Board.
may continue.
Yes.
That document that we're talking about now, this commission of 1998, consists of 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 pages. All signed by the Diamond Court members and the members of the DSC. Every paragraph, every page has been paraphrased, has been fine, come fine. So everything is there. Now, the diamonds that were exported in 1993. Now, he produced a document here which is a permit that was signed and sealed in 1998. Now, can I ask you a question on the permission, the agreement that you have with the board, which is the 1992 agreement? Do you have a copy of that document? It was signed, it was approved at a meeting of the SA Diamond Board, 3rd December 1992.
Yes, I do.
Now, can you tell me, sir, who signed on this agreement on behalf of the DSC?
Chairperson, the document was submitted to the DSC on the cover of a letter of the 13th of January 1993, a testament of intent from the DSC by the chief executive, or by the then chief executive of the Diamond Board, and he enclosed a copy of the agreement, appears in a letter dated 12 February 1993, wrote back to the senior executive of the Diamond Board accepting and confirming the new agreement that has been concluded by between the board, the DSC and its associated companies in terms of Section 59 of the Diamond Act. 1996, and the letter under reference standards that closed the set out correctly the terms and conditions of the new agreement, which are hereby confirmed on behalf of the DSC and its associated companies, signed by Mr.
So I'll get back to the letter you're referring to now, but I'd like to know who has signed this document, this agreement. Remember the agreement of 1998 had 4 signatures, 5 signatures at every place. Now we're talking about here the 1992 agreement. Can you show me where the Beers or the Diamond Board signed this agreement and paraphrased
it? That the 1992 arrangement constitutes an agreement made up in 3 parts. One is, as my colleague suggested, the terms of the agreement contain in 2-3 pages. The second is a letter from the Diamond Board, written by the chief executive to the bureau, acknowledging that the 1992 agreement is a new agreement, acknowledging that the Diamond Board has set the terms and conditions of the new agreement. When the beer is right back.
So, just give us a second here. What is the question?
I'm not being answered because you see, you're talking about the 1998, which was signed everywhere. Now you're referring to accompanying letters of the 1992. We're not saying the agreement, the actual agreement. There's no signature, either from you or the Diamond.
Our position that that the three documents in 1992 constitute an agreement. The layer consists of, as I say, a letter from the Diamond Board offering the new terms, signed by the chief executive, and attachment containing those conditions of the agreement, not signed by anybody, and the letter back from the finance director of the deal at the time, accepting the terms and conditions. So our position would be that constitutes a written agreement, albeit that an extended term is not signed by each party.
If I may continue, now you refer to this letter that was addressed to your Mr. Lincoln. Now this is a letter that, and a copy of the agreement that we've been waiting for and looking for 13 years, that you only produced in August. This is the letter. Talking about this letter. There's all this much, and it looks like it's part of the back of the bus. This is the letter.
Is that letter dated 13 January 1993 in the top right hand corner?
That's Now, you see, I have a problem with this. Because this was done in 1993, before we had 20 computers to change lettering or whatever. Now, there are three different types of letters, lettering on this list. Have you noticed that? If you look at yours sincerely at the bottom there, that's different lettering. It looks like it has been maybe put in half of it.
Oh, sincere. The judge has no knowledge of how the product can find a complete product or a technical achievement. But the judge certainly regards the letter as a valid achievement. There's no suggestion of the achievement.
Now, if this was a legal agreement, we should say it was. This document that hasn't been signed by anybody. But you're insisting that the company is making it legal. But now, if you're insisting this is a legal document and you have a permission to export the diamonds, which is this is basically a blanket. Why did you go and get another commission in 1998? Because you already had one in 1992.
Chair, over the years, the terms of the, what I've called using the Section 59 changed. They changed by virtue of circumstances. They changed by virtue of what was going on in the industry. So it's not correct to say that there was only one Section 59 agreement. There was a prior one, prior to 1992, then there was the 1992 agreement that we just demonstrated, and only for the record, I can just point out that at the end of the attachment containing the terms in the 1992 letter, there is language which that reads as follows. Approve the agreement will be subject to annual review. So each year, our understanding is that the Diamond Board reviews the terms of the agreement. Our understanding, if you look through the minutes of the Diamond Board from 1992 onwards, there are confirmations that the 1992 agreement continues in the same terms until a new agreement was negotiated, and there are slightly different terms in the 1998 agreement and the 1992 agreement. So that would explain why it needs to change the agreement. As to why a formal agreement was signed in 1998, done by the same letters. I'm sorry, I can't shed any light on it at the time, but our submission would be that both of the agreements are perfectly standard legal documents. And that the 1998 one clearly refers to the existence of a prior agreement which is terminated by the 1980 agreement, which then replaces it.
That's like you say, that is your submission that it might be a legal document. But may I ask just another question? Was the 1992 board resolution that referred to the mutual consent by the relevant parties such as yourself and the board in concluding this new section 1989 agreement together with the agreement allowed for blanket diamond export duty exemption for treatment on the scale of top class transshipment values at about 820 million? Was it preceded by lengthy negotiations, or did it just come by one board meeting?
My understanding is that it was preceded by lengthy negotiations. The reason being, the 1992 agreement changed the way in which diamonds were exported and then being imported for local trading in South Africa. In 1987, the years consolidated diamonds were exported pursuant to a valid exemption and then re-imported. Those which were economically manufacturable were re-imported into South Africa. The industry asked for the years in the 1990 and intended, if I may, point out the original of the letter from the South African Diamond Board of 13 January 1993, signed in original by the chief executive officer, which will make you end up.
Continue, Mr. Harrow.
Chair, that will assist if we can get the original one. Now, the discussions on this agreement, do you have copies of the discussions that you had with the board, or was it given to a subcommittee? But I think in terms of the act, the subcommittee can actually consist of one person as well. But are there any documentation regarding the discussions?
Chairman, I confer with a colleague of mine.
I'd just like to know what motivated the Beers on the eve of the change of government in into a new democratic South Africa, to ship 20 million carats of uncut diamonds to London, only to re-import some of it afterwards. I mean, we've already mentioned that diamonds being about $900 million, the tax on that $135 million in tax in 1992 already. A company like that, which is like an institution, why is that all of a sudden under change? I mean, it really raises questions, serious questions. That's probably why we're sitting here.
Grateful for the opportunity to answer that question. That there's a strong view of the misconception. We have the misconception that you very much like to use intellectually. We have comprehensive evidence of every single stone that was exported by the Beers from at least 1991. We have comprehensive evidence that in the 1993 year, broadly speaking, no more than the Beers' normal production was exported in that year. Substantially or even much out of line with the volumes and value that were exported the previous year, 1992, and not substantially different to what was exported in 1994. So we very much like to place the Beers' position is that the Beers did not agree with that allegation. One way of assisting the members of the committee in this regard is, it was also stated earlier that the non-substitution of the United Agreement give rise to a blanket exemption. That's not quite correct, of course, because in order to export the diamonds, even if you have a Section 59 agreement valid in terms of Section 63 of the Act, you still need for every single shipment of diamonds that is exported a certificate of exemption. Here it has comprehensive records of valid certificates of exemption for all the diamonds exported over the period, and would be happy to substantiate that in the 1993 year in question, the amounts in question were not put to us, but were broadly speaking in line with the Beers production of that year, and there wasn't a material spike in the amount of diamonds exported prior to the 1994 election.
So before you come in here, let me just find out from the Beers. We have documentation from the auditors that says differently. Now I'm not sure if you are aware or in possession of that. Your statement that the average amount of exports remains constant or reasonably constant is not the information that we have from the auditor. Now, I want to check from the auditor general often the information that you provide to the committee. What was the source of it? You're talking about your document that you gave us yesterday on page number 7. Where there's a substantial difference between South African diamond sales in 1992 from any other year. Could you give us where that information was sourced from?
Thank you, Chair. The information that was supplied was received from the Department of Environment and Energy in terms of their records that they kept in terms of.
And so just before we allow those diamond exports, can we presume the exports were all or mostly from the Beers? Could there be any other organization that exported those diamonds? Or are they the Beers diamonds?
Chair, in terms of our information, that's the total production, but as you know, the Beers was the biggest production.
Thank you very much. We just want to set the record straight. But the information that we have is that exports in 1992 were 4.6 billion, as opposed to 1.7 billion the year before and 1.8 billion the year after. In other words, 1993 was 1.8, 1991 was 1.7, 1992, 4.7. So, I'm highlighting this to the Beers because he's just indicated to us that from
your point of view, there was no sight. We have evidence to the contrary. We can just regard. So,
can you just ask for the clarity? Can you just be sure that you understand the difference between export and sales? Because there could be a difference, and I think we just need to understand that. Because this opening speaks of sales, and maybe we should just get clarity on that at the same time that we're discussing this particular issue.
The point of order is, you are here.
No, hold on, hold on, I haven't allowed you to speak. Can we ask the Auditor General about page 7 specifically? Are we talking about sales or are we talking about export?
The column SA Diamond Sales pertains to domestic sales plus export, total sales.
All right. Now that we have clarity on that one, do you want to say something, Sophia?
Chairperson, it may actually be helpful if we receive, for example, the report. This information, because we are aware of an order that was performed somewhere relatively late at the time. We have not received the copy thereof. So we are today not in a position to respond, but clearly we can say the information that's not that is presented to now is not the information we have. So it may be useful for us to actually engage the information and then be able to do something.
We have a problem that I was hoping was not going to arise. Disputing of future testimony. Because it doesn't take us anywhere. It doesn't take us anywhere. It's severe that disputing figures given to Parliament by the Auditor General, and we operate from the basis that the Auditor General is our source of information. It really takes us nowhere. It takes us nowhere. And maybe the Department of Mineral and Energy is where we got this documentation, or we got this information from. Are you able to share some light on the information that we are now using as a basis for our interrogation of the fact? Is there any, just on the point of, was there a spike in terms of exports between 1991, 1992, and 1993. What does the graph look like from your point of view?
Thank you, Chair. Well, the information as far as what concerns is that we gave it to the Auditor General. So we can confirm what the Auditor General said.
All right. As far as this committee is concerned, we will take the information from the Auditor General and the peers. In the event that you want to dispute it, we'll have to come with evidence to the contrary. Unfortunately, our source is the Auditor General, and unless there's a reason that the Auditor General's information is inaccurate, it's the information we're going to use. But we will give you the information that we have to allow you an opportunity to interrogate it later on. But we're going to move from the position that there was indeed a fact in 1992. Mr. Trent, is your question answered?
DCRI, on that particular issue. Clarity there, and I think that clearly we need to get absolute certainty on that particular issue in court.
No, we will do so. If you put your mic up, Mr. Chen, let's take the Auditor General and then here will allow you to conclude before we allow somebody else.
Here we have a copy of the South African Mineral Industry book, the SAMI, Directorate Mineral Economics, DME. And so we have the table on page 24 for the 2005-2006 copy, where they indicate South Africa's rough diamond production 1987 to 1996. Now, just to review the total production, which is kimberlite, alluvial, and marine, in carats, not in rainbows. 1987 total production for South Africa was 10.2 million. 1988 was 9 million, 1989 was 8.5 million, 1990, 9.1 million, 1991, 8.7 million, 92, 8.4 million, 93, 10.1 million, 10.2, by rounding it, 1994, 10.8, 1995 it dropped back to 9.7, and 1996 it was 9.9. So to say that a transshipment of 20 million carats is equal to annual production is not correct. It's double, basically, annual production.
Mr. Herbert.
So just for clarity, so based on the 1992 agreement, which you insist are legal, you haven't paid any export duty right up to 2007, am I correct, on any diamond that was exported?
Chairperson, the number that we have before us started in 1992.
Sorry, just before you continue.
Are those numbers of export?
Export and production.
Export and production. And are they different to the figures that the Auditor General has given us? If they are, I don't want to open a debate here. Just give us that information. We'll interrogate it ourselves. If you're disputing the figures that we've received, please supply us with that information, but I don't want to open up a dialogue between the Auditor General and the DS now. The question before the House, before you now, was, have you been paying duties on exports since 1992? Yes? Did you have a question?
Have you paid since 1992, since this agreement that we discussed, have you paid any export duties on the exports of diamonds, bunker diamonds to London?
The judge has complied entirely with the law from 1991 with the method of exporting diamonds in general, entirely with a valid certificate of obligation. And if I may, should be worth reminding the committee that it's not so simple as the judge has exported the diamonds and they've never been used. I don't think that, of course, the principal general position is denied. Those diamonds, the local industry believes it could economically impact on South Africa, would have a conditional regulation be re-imported from 1992 onwards out of the London mix back into South Africa for patents.
Sir, so what are you saying to us? That since 1992, you didn't pay duties because there was a legal exemption?
It is operated in accordance with the law with a valid exemption.
For the record, you're saying that you had an exemption. At some point, if we ask you to prove or to give us a copy of that exemption, you will be in a position to do so. Thank you. Here are you through.
Now, based on what you just said previously, now, is that you can give recollection of every stone and the detail of every stone that you take to.
Yes, that's correct. We have a valid certificate of exemption, but it is part of the fact that I tell you that you don't get a certificate for each and every stone, but you get one through every shipment that is shipped. You would say we have a valid certificate of exemption for each stone.
Okay, before you continue, let's short circuit. Can we have those exemptions?
With pleasure.
Before you leave today?
We can give you copies of the exemptions for the relevant year, being the 93 year. It's a large file. We're very happy to leave it with the committee, and we can produce any other documentation that we require.
We're asking for exemptions since 1993 today.
We can produce all of that, but we don't have all of that with us. That's a large amount of documentation. What you have with us is the 93 year, because that's obviously the year we came to talk about, and we'd be very happy to leave that with you and to assemble copies of all of the remaining documentation, which we do have.
Okay, we'll agree how we examine those exemptions after this, but we're certainly going to have a look at them, whether it's on your premises or our premises, we'll conclude that. Let's take the AJ.
Okay, I think we're talking about the 92 record, so if that is possible to be submitted as well.
Possible? Thank you.
Yeah. 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 We need to do just a couple of minutes. In terms of your legal opinion that you got from your advocate, S.G. Loxton, says the 11.3, with reference to Chapter 6, the diamond, in the kingdom in particular, that diamond is not, in our view, significant. Firstly, in terms of Section 6A of the interpretation of 97, unless contrary intention appears, work in the kingdom is poor. Secondly, a reading of Chapter 6 which requires that diamonds must be offered for sale stone by stone, the diamond cutters or must be valued stone by stone, with having regard to the quantities of gold for each of the observed results. There is a presumption in our law that the legislature does not intend observed or unreasonable results. And I just wanted to mention this to you because you said that you have evidence of each and every stone or particles of stone that you're dealing with. Chair, my last question I would just like to ask, if I may. The head office of the Beers, is that in Johannesburg or Kimberley or where in church? I'd like to ask something about that.
The head office of the Beers,
I've got
that in mind.
Okay, now, in terms of the $900 million that was shipped out on that consignment of diamonds, the RSC levies on that, which is calculated at 0.1051%, which amounts to $1.44 million, times 7.99, which is about 11.5 million. Although RSC levies have been paid, have you paid the RSC levies on the shipment? Because we can't find trace of it.
Firstly, I fully understand your case to say the differences, but for the record, of course, it is just for that particular information. Secondly, I'm not in a position right now to answer that question. I have little doubt that the RSC levies were paid, and if the committee requires us to look into that and substantiate that,
please do. Yeah, I have to move on. I recognize Ron and then Mr. Chen and then Mr. Cody.
Yeah, I think I must come up, but I wanted to just see the that I had it here. I mean, Section 15 of our agreement is in place in the handbook of the government. And then the only question for cover was the yes, what was more for the board. I heard the board, I mean the diamond board saying that was easier for the board to whatever which will be happening. But now, what confronts me is that since it has been discussed, I mean, for many years, up to now, it doesn't seem to have any follow-up as you have made as your board member. So, that note which is a court now. How far has it done? I do hear it that takes the travel and what in I know what type of information that you can say or what has happened now. Right at this point it's up to
I think first of all I should qualify what I'm going to say by confirming that the diamond board was established in terms of the diamond act and as an institution that is based up in terms of that super certification, we have to comply with the legislation. On the other hand, we have constraints. For instance, the Section 59 agreement seems to be given the main bone of contention, if you may, between different departments and the Diamond Board. Throughout, we have to comply with the Act and with Section 59 as enshrined. And I think whatever constraints we may have had, and one is pleased that it has been abolished in amended and now we have a complete new act. The second thing is that we have instituted investigations on several occasions and there are documents that were not available at that particular time and they keep on coming up. For instance, I can assure you that the file I have here has got all the documents that we have received from the board, that is the treaty of administration. And also from the year. But there may be one or two documents that we could not have in our file. And as to what happened, so first of all, if the diamond bar itself does not have lots of recommends to record that you need it as a new watch, and in fact, of several layers to acquire that information. We even checked with DME, DME didn't have such information. And I think we tried our best within you know, our constraints to provide as much information.
Okay, Teddy. Mr. Chen, sir.
Thank you, Chair. See, I think the main issues we have covered regarding the legality of the agreement, etc., that's a matter of law, and I'm not an advocate or aware. I don't think the government's intention is to try and do that. Two issues that are sort of connected with each other, just concern me a little, and perhaps we can get Mr. Stokely. The first is, the way I understand is that in terms of this Section 59 agreement, the production for each year must be offered on an annual basis. And yet the talk of stockpiling now, to me, if you offer each year your total production, stockpiling could then only apply to what you did not sell. You would have to then carry that over. That would have, that's the amount of character to my list, it would have to be offered and it would be subject to the degree. So, it is alleged that there was 20 million carats accumulated and then exported or sold one single year. I think that we need to get clarity on that. But that clearly, my view, would constitute not what the act had intended. That's my first question.
No, let's interrogate the first one that you answered the second one just now.
Yeah, the second one's connected to
okay.
Because I think what we're talking about now, as the Chair said earlier, we're talking about diamond export duty. That's really what we're interested in, but that's really needs to be said. Now, what I find strange is in the document that we were supplied with by the AG, it gives the diamond sales, which you're aware of, for 1991, 92, 93, 94, I think you've got those figures. Which does seem to be consistent. But then they've got a diamond export duty status, and this to me is totally incomprehensible. In 1990, the total amount of duty paid was 2,658. And then 1,160. And then in 92, when it's the ministry of export and sold 4.6 billion rand with a diamond, the tax was 399 left. Now, I just don't understand how that can happen. And surely, you pay no tax if you're potential. But where does 399 land? It doesn't make sense.
I
said that this is not only the bid.
And that's the answer, is that there were two producers of Section 59 agreement, and there were other producers who had a different regime of time, and therefore would have paid duty. So that can't answer the question. And you could agree that that would probably explain why you need some duty in your
so therefore, just to follow up?
No. Before you follow up, we lose the first question about the stockpiling. When the app indicates that you need to make it available annually, we are now understanding that there was a breach on that, because otherwise how do you get to the view that there was stockpiled? If you could explain that.
In the first instance, just to remind everybody, we don't agree with that number. Our figures show that there was a stock of the order of 1.6 million carats. Nothing like the number. The 1992 agreement very clearly at the end of the last paragraph says that, and I quote, the full production, other than certain diamonds, will be incorporated into the London selling mix, from which in turn diamonds will be allocated to the FA cycle. This will apply to any accumulated stock held in FA at the time the new agreement becomes effective. Now, probably worthwhile understanding what happened in practice. In practice, is what an annual report called a layout. One run of all the entire year's production was laid out in Kimberley over five floors, and the whole floor. And the diamond board
think the committee wants to ask. You might as well ask. Are you saying to Parliament that De Beers did not hold back, for want of a better word, any of your production with a deliberate attempt to have a stockpile to move our place? I think that's the question, and maybe we should move away from being nice to each other and just be frank. Are you saying to us that prior to 1992, when there was this supposedly big stockpile that was shipped to London, you were disputing this? Is that what you're saying to us? Because what you're saying to us now is that nothing seems to have been untoward. And I mean, we are suggesting to you, quite frankly, that there was something untoward, because there was a stockpile, and that stockpile was shipped out just before the election. That's our contention, and we'd like you to see that.
Thank you, Chair. With the future allegation, clearly, De Beers maintains stockpiles around the world, and De Beers are not suggesting it to the contrary. What we are saying is that our records show that the amount of stock on hand at the time was substantially less than what has been put to us today, and that it was certainly not withheld in order to avoid any kind of duty. It was ultimately shipped in 1992 so that it could form part of the London mix, and so that all those diamonds could now be mixed with other diamonds in London, as I was trying to explain earlier. So Beers would refute any suggestion that they were stockpiling in order to ship a large volume, an abnormally large volume of diamonds prior to the 1994 election.
Okay. Now we've written a question. We're going to ask you hard questions, sir, and we expect honest answers from you. But Mr. Trent, before I move on to Mr. Gordy, are you through with your question?
I just wanted to conclude on the question of the import duty.
Yes, sir.
Because that has been explained, and we understand that surely you were not the only importer. But are you saying that you were not liable to pay any export duty whatsoever during that period in terms of your question? Yes. So therefore, you believe that you did not have any requirements by any
export. We had a requirement, of course, to comply with the law, and once we had a valid exemption, which was all in terms of Section 59, and all premised on us reimporting back into South Africa the volume of garbage required.
Thank you. Let's move on to Mr. Terva, you indicated that you follow up, and then we'll move to the story.
Yes, maybe on the issue of the 20 million carats, or the alleged 20 million carats, and you are saying you mentioned the figure of 1.7 million carats, 1.6 million. Maybe, because the people from the Auditor General's office who are here went to London to inspect this, and maybe they can give us also their side of the story in terms of the volume of carats that were taken out of that ship.
We also, before you answer, Auditor General, we want the department to give us its view. Was there a stockpile or was there no stockpile? We want the board to give us its view, because we seem to be now disputing whether there was a stockpile or not. So the AG will give us what your understanding is. We're going to ask the DG to give us his understanding, and we're going to ask the board to give us their understanding. And then, before you do that, Mr. Okay. Let's allow Mr. Gordy, and then we will move in that fashion.
Yeah, thank you, Complex. I think for me that would probably be the crux of the matter. Because if indeed there was an abnormal quantity that was set up in relation to what we know, that becomes the basis of the concerns that have led to the problem coming up to me. So clarity and confirmation in terms of whether or not there was an abnormal quantity that was, you know, that was shipped out would be very critical in determining how we move forward before I come to that point.
Okay. Please, if you could ask AJ to give us your sense of what happened. AJ?
Thank you, Jay. Our check that we've provided is derived from two audit reports by PKF, which was appointed by the Diamond Board Evaluator at the time to look into the stockpile, and the figures that were quoted and that was reported for SCOPA is the figures that came from the two reports of the PKF auditor.
And PKF?
PKF is the, as I said, the auditors that were appointed in London by the Diamond Board. data at the time, and there's two reports sent March and April 1999 those figures.
Can we ask for comment from the DG?
Thank you very much, sir. According to our understanding, there are other problems.
Can we ask for comment from the Diamond Board?
Yes, I want to talk.
Thank you very much, Mr. Bodhi. Can you continue?
Yeah, thank you, sir. I want to just make an observation that as you'll be well aware that this issue has been up for quite some time. And the reason for it being a protected matter was classified and primarily because there appears to be no availability of information that could assist the various role players to reach control the position. And in our last engagement with the department and the Diamond Board, you recall that we felt that maybe it would be proper if we have GPS here as well, so that in terms of the role players involved, could have some element of completeness. And what is of concern to me is the fact that the DGS appears to be much more than willing to provide information that they have as I listen to their input here. And the question that I have is, if DGS is so willing to provide information, why has it not happened all along? Is it because the department or the Diamond Board should not contact DGS, or be able to access to, you know, to play along all along, which raises, I think, some of the questions that the committee raised later on in terms of, you know, not being too heavy or being taken up by documentation that we have before us when all along we have not been available. And I would imagine that the gentleman from DGS, if they were in our shoes, probably as skeptical as they are. So I'm not sure really whether it's the board that should come in or it's the DGS. Why has it taken so long to provide any documentation that has been brought by the whole institution that was brought up to the up to now?
Can we ask for a response on that matter? Either the DGS or the board. What was the reason for the difficulty of getting documentation before us to make an opinion? It seems now that the documentation is readily available, but it has taken us a long time and lots of pain to get this document. Does somebody want to explain or give us a rationale? Let's start with the board and then we'll go to the board.
Well, the simplest answer is that we have the Institute of Investigations on this matter, and on the board we have members of the DGS that are represented on the board in terms of legislation. And we have always approved that those were individuals that were our contact points, and at any given time every information we needed would come from them. However, that didn't happen, and subsequently we either had to write a letter to the Chief Executive Officer or the Director of DGS requesting the same information, and we got part of it. And if there's any other information that is not available, it's simply because it hasn't been presented to us. But there is information that was provided to us only after I have written the letter to the Chief Executive Officer.
Mr. Bias, comment? Thank you, sir. Mr.
Bias? Insofar as the formal request from the Diamond Board dated the 22nd of February 2006, the request of solicitation for information, and we supplied all the information required in the request, and the cover for it is 2 days later, the 24th of February 2006. Within 2 days, we supplied the information requested. Insofar as the 1999 PKF all this was done by my colleague.
Thank you, sir.
Chair, making this observation, we obviously have no knowledge of the 1999 audit, although we've asked on a number of occasions to see a copy of it. Our understanding has been confirmed by KT, which is that it's done in 1999. Now, really, 1999 was a different time from 1992.
thought you were very careful when you said that is your concern.
A month later, Mr. L.A. Lincoln
response to that letter saying that they accept or confirm that the Diamond Board, yeah, basically writing saying that they accept those two pieces of paper. The gears are saying to us constitute an agreement, and it's on that basis that they move on. We're not going to dispute whether that's right or wrong now. We just want to understand that this is what you're saying, so that we take that and do our own homework. So that is the position. Okay. And we're not going to debate whether it's an agreement, whether it's legal, whether it's binding, not in this issue, we'll do that somewhere else. So that is an agreement, but I see you violently pushing your hand up. AG, please help us. We want you to get to a point where when we take a decision, our decision is well informed.
Thank you, Chair. I'd just like to point out as well that the other agreement at the time concluded between the Diamond Board and the other operators was done in a similar way as the former agreements as well as the later agreement. This was the only agreement that differed in terms of the way in which the agreement was drawn up, signed on each page, and eventually voted as the section was denied again. But by saying that, I would just like confirmation to the chair that the previous agreements that is being referred to in this agreement of 92, being the ones 87 to 92, do we perhaps have a copy of those agreements available there? And in what way does the 92 agreement differ from the format of the previous agreement that has been included?
Before you move on, could we request everybody with cell phones please to put them off? Because it really affects our quality of transcription. Everybody, not on silence, you could put your phone off. To be able to respond to that question.
My understanding to the chair is that there was a one-page letter in 1982 constitution agreement written by an executive officer of the Diamond Board to the for the period 1982, so there wasn't a formal agreement signed in the short.
Can we move on to Mr. Trent and Mr. Herbert?
Chair, yes, I'm going to deviate slightly from what you've been talking about. In respect of the Diamond Board, the way it was constituted at the time was completely different to what it is now. And you understand that the opinion was not there at the time, and therefore very difficult for you to ask questions. But Mr. Hamlew was the chair at that time. Is he available? And other members of the board at that time, are they available? Could they be called? Could we have access to them as a committee? Because I think we need to close the circle. Because that's the one, to me, the one part of the circle that's missing is to hear what it is that they have to say. So do you have contact numbers for them, and so that you could get hold of them?
Interesting enough, they are still available, most of them, and some of them are probably still there on some of the boards. But I just want to make a comment at some point, and I hope this will be in order, Mr. Chair.
Go ahead.
I so wish this matter could be brought to a logical conclusion. In my view, having participated in this discussion for so long without reaching any conclusion, there are basically two issues. A, being the legality of this issue and the legality of the very Section 59. And secondly, the left. So there is a financial issue and there's a legal issue. It does look like if the DAS and the Auditor General, of course, and the National Treasurer could sit down and reach some understanding on the exact figure and determine whether or not there is anything that is owed to the state, I think that would partly resolve the matter, and such a report could be presented to yourself. And secondly, the other part of it is the legality of the matter is that it tends to be a little bit more complicated because I can only imagine, and I would like to submit what the U.S. is going to say, whatever agreements or resolutions or anything that were approved by the board at that particular time, I can only guess that the U.S. would regard that as constituting an agreement, irrespective of the format in which there was presented to the jury. So there are two issues. The legal side of it, I think it can be dealt with without necessarily going to any court, but basically by reaching some understanding of what happened and the clause. But the second one, which is most important, is the financial. And if you did that, you wouldn't have to come back here again, because you have the opportunity to even interview Mr. Benderman, who was the chief executive at that time, who still around. You also have other people. But I think this matter was gradually, you know, for a much longer period, when in fact all the parties involved are here. And I think you could actually bring it to the logical conclusion without taking the answer.
Thank you, sir. We were going to do exactly that. One way or the other, SCOPO today was going to pronounce on this matter. And that is why I continue to say that we want to understand what you think. Because once we pronounce on it, we will defend it. And if it means damage to the AG's reputation or means damage to the beer, so be it. We will defend it as SCOPO. And that's why we are very careful today that we understand what it is that you are saying. What we are not going to do is going to have another hearing on the beer. We're just not going to have another hearing. One way or the other, we'll pronounce and we'll persuade Parliament to adopt whatever it is. And it will be for the record. So thank you very much. That's exactly what you think that we wanted to do. And that is why I was very persistent in not getting into a legalistic argument. Let us repeat. The Cooper's view is, does the Beers have an obligation to pay the state for any taxes that it did not pay? And if it did, how do we go about doing that? If they don't, we close the chapter and move on. That is our interest in this matter. So that is the end game that we want to play. So Mr. Trent and I think Mr. Herber, let's stick away from the legalistic part. If there's anything else you want in terms of information gathering, to assist us with our resolution from a financial point of view, I'm going to allow you to ask the question, and then Mr. Herber, and then we'll try and wrap up in terms of what is it that we have, what is it that we might require, and by when can you expect a pronouncement at least from our side. Mr.
Yes, I'm happy that there's nothing further that we can glean from the party present here today. I did suggest that it might be useful to talk to people that are not here, the committee would decide upon that in a way. So I don't think it's necessary to get a question from our.
Thank you, Mr. Trent. Mr. Harris?
Chair, just two short questions. The one may be as in the way we touched on by the AG's office, and that is the letter of the beer acknowledging the 92 agreement. And also the letter from the Diamond Board, you know, it starts off with the one from the Diamond Board would be starting off with new agreement. And later on in the context of the letter, it refers to new agreement. But the one from the Beers actually refers to this new agreement 3 or 4 times in the letter, which makes it funny. But now, the only question that I think for myself that I need clarity on. I've read through this unsigned document, this agreement which is legal, the 92 one. Now, nowhere in this agreement is there a date which says you've got permission to send my 96 or whatever. It's an open-ended, the 92 one. Now, why, if you have an open-ended, without a cut-off date agreement like this, why would you then go and have another agreement insist on another one in 1998? This is the one question I'd like to ask.
No. That's because we want to move to closure. Let's ask that question, get an answer to it, agree to or disagree on your answer, and move to the next one. Give me a
second. The answer to that is in the last paragraph of the debate, that's what paragraph 8. It clearly stated that as far as 92 being concerned, the agreement will be subject to annual review. It was not an evergreen agreement that was continued. It was reviewed by the board and its members every year. And by the time 1998 came along, there seemed to be the same circumstances which required a new agreement. It's not correct to say that it was an evergreen agreement. It was an agreement which was subject to annual review and therefore.
28th of March 1995 and the 22nd of January 1996 interviews of which the board reviewed the agreement and confirmed that it was continued to another year.
So in 7 years, the board only reviewed the fact that you say.
Chairperson, I just wanted to pick it up. This is what I have to see now. I will probably have to go and get the report. But for the purpose of this meeting, this is to show that we have the information that indeed the MOU was viewed up before.
Let me put a question to the chief so that you don't get it. During that period, are you aware, as you said here, are you aware that there was an annual review of the agreement? Not what you brought to you. Are you aware that there was any annual review as you are suggesting your last paragraph was?
Our understanding is that the Section 59 Committee did review the agreement.
Thank you. That helps us answer that question. Any other questions from members of Parliament besides Mr. Herber? I'll give you last, I just don't know if it should be a Herber versus a Beers thing. Any other member of SOPA that wants to ask a question? No? Okay, then Mr. Herber, you will...
the 15% tax, which was applicable at that stage, was raised in 1996 from 50% from 10% tax to 15% tax. It was also a year that there was a saturation of the then finance funding all these kind of things. But anyway, the question I'd like to ask is,
don't consider that last comment.
But Chair, what I would like to ask is, in the hindsight of when this Act, the 1986 Act, was debated on Friday, the 30th of May, the Minister mentioned here that the then Minister, the Committee of Inquiry into Exchange Control and Tax and Malpractices, the Brown Committee, to the effect that, and I quote, millions of rands in the form of tax and foreign currency are involved. The committee in question made this finding with specific reference to practices such as transfer pricing and artificial pricing in the exporting environment. I would just like to know, was the BS audited by SAP at any stage in terms of anti-transfer pricing tax legislation and any regulations?
As a general observation, so I can't answer the question without digging into the record in the year in question, because it has been subject to a large number of audits by the staff over the years. I can't answer it more specifically than that, unless you give me more specific dates, which I will take the moment.
Thanks. I'm going to bring this proceeding to an end by just contextualizing for everybody so that nobody walks out of here with different understandings. The first thing is that we are asking Sabir to give us a copy of your export duty exemption for the years 1992 and 1993. We are asking to give us that. We also want Sabir to go and investigate whether you paid RSC levies. We also want to indicate here that in terms of the agreement or otherwise of a stockpile, the Auditor General, the Departments of Mineral and Energy, and the Diamond Board confirmed that in their understanding there was a stockpile in 1992. Tobias has a different view. We are asking you to give us that information, because that is critical to our decision. So those are the requirements that we'd want as soon as possible so that we can solve this matter. Also, just to make everybody understand that we are politicians. We get a report from the Auditor General that indicates that a large corporate citizen of this country had a stockpile. He took it out of the country just before election. Didn't pay duty. A question that I want to ask later on, but I'll ask it afterwards.
So that's the one side. The second side is that the regulator, the board, who is supposed to be the regulator, is skewed in favor of business as opposed to government. So they're regulating themselves. And the fact that there's a change of regime imminent. So those are the things that tricked our mind. There's no way that as Parliament that we cannot ask questions of the government. I think we also have to send a signal that no corporate, however big it is untouchable. Nobody's untouchable. You break the law, we will come after you. Certainly from our point of view as Parliament that is mandated by the Constitution to have oversight. So there must not be a perception that there's anybody, whether it's a department or a individual, that is beyond accountability. The Constitution is very clear that this committee can call anybody to account. DG of a department or even a civilian, if we think that the matters are serious enough. So it's in that context that we've called the BS. It's in that context that we want to conclude and send a message that all of us are accountable. So you are going to assist that, but I also want to reiterate, I don't think that we're going to have another engagement like this. We will make a ruling, we will live by it as COPA, and defend whatever ruling we make. And the auditor generally live by it in terms of your reputation or otherwise, and the BS you live with it, and the board, the future board, would live by it. We will pronounce on all these matters, whether we think the board has a role to play in future, in terms of how it's constituted and exactly what it should be doing. We are able to change from the experiences that we've learned here. So thank you very much, Mr. BS, for having come here. Our appeal can only be that you give us that documentation as soon as possible. We'd like to put this letter to rest. Auditor General and the peers and the board, you know, you are going to, you will help us if somehow or the other. And that's not going to be, we're not going to wait for that record. But it would help us if you guys can just agree on the common matter of whether there was or wasn't. The matter that the board is talking about, not the legal part, but the financial part, because that is core in terms of what the levy was. Even if it was exempt, I want to be able to go back and say that in 1992, if there was no exemption, we would have been in a position to collect X amount of rent. But because of the exemption, we didn't collect X amount of rent. Currently, we can't say that as Parliament. And we want to say that so we can put this to bed. And in future, they were to ask the question about whether this exemption helps the country or does it help capital. And if it helps capital, how does capital come back to the party? If it helps the country, how does the country ensure that capital is helped? That's the bottom line from our point of view. So we'd like the board and the Auditor General to get that finality for us. Thank you very much. COPA has received whatever it wants to receive. We will go away and we will do our resolution to Parliament, and you'll hear no more from COPA, but you'll hear from Parliament. This will be a report of Parliament. Mr. Herbert, close it for us.
Chairman, just the one thing I think that we need to ask for again is the RFC levy.
Yes.
That's one thing. And then also, if we get the transcript of the hearing, if there might be other questions.
What we will do is as we indicated. The process from here forward is that we will get the transcript, we will get all this information, we will craft and design our resolution. If there's need to ask a question or two, we will certainly do it. But it's going to be telephonic or it's going to be writing, we are not going to meet the discussion again. On tomorrow's MacArthur Day.
Chairperson, Colonel Wilson, from our side, thank you for the opportunity. Thank you for the education. And we remain committed to play our part and ensure what is right is done. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, everybody. We'll have a 5-minute break. Our next guests are here. So if we could go outside and have a 5-minute body break and you see me immediately. Thank you very much.
Yes, I talk to your colleague very often, Kemda.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Hi. How are you?
Good luck.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Yes, Mr. D. Smith. Lincoln Smith here. Yeah.
Okay. And then the gentleman who was
speaking here, he said, did he?
Yes.
Oh, it's a Taiwan.
Sometimes it's very convenient.
So there's something that you should be taking.
Yeah.
Thank you very much.
clarifying that. This is my arrangement. And I'm Vincent Smith, member of COPEC. We, again, for background purposes, we interacted with the CETA on transport at COPEC. There were revelations of investments in that organization that we thought were not necessarily the wisest and the best move from a value for money point of view, from tax point of taxpayers' point of view, and the rest was history in terms of what had happened. We've interacted with the CETA itself, members of the board. We've interacted with the auditors, and very much like the previous one, you are the last leg of that interaction from an information gathering and our own understanding of what transpired. So our intention is just to get from you, sir, or from the curators, in as far as the CETA is concerned. I'm sure your business in the residential goes beyond the CETA, but just as far as the CETA is concerned, where we ask what is it that you're doing, what is it that we can expect. We also are very aware that some of these things you couldn't necessarily divulge because of other processes that are happening, whether in court or otherwise. So we'll also try and be sensitive in terms of our own questions so that it doesn't jeopardize or compromise whatever you're doing outside of this interaction. So we will allow you to very briefly, 10-15 minutes, just to tell us where you're at, what is it that you're doing. We then allow members of COPA to then engage with whatever it is that you've given us, and we decide on our own how we take the process forward. So I would want to allow the curators 15 minutes max just to tell us where you're at, what are the types of things you're doing. Our interest is to, as far as humanly possible, recover money that is intended for the use of training, skills development, and that type of thing. That's really our interest. We're not interested in the other matters. So at the end of the day, if we could have that type of understanding when we conclude our business here, as hope, I think, would be enriched. So, sir, close your.
Thank you, Chair. I appreciate those introductory comments that you make, specifically with reference to the sensitivity of certain issues. My co-curator and I come here today in the spirit of wanting to fully cooperate with COPA and give whatever information we can. The only caveat we have is not to compromise the process that we are currently engaged in with a view to recovering whatever happened. Capable of being recovered, and the simple reason for that is to that prejudice the very institution that you wish to protect, being the speaker, and all the interests you are concerned with, would be prejudiced as well. We're all in this thing together. So, yes, I would be welcome. When it comes to asking questions, we answer those questions as clearly and frankly as we can possibly, under the circumstances, given that caveat. The position currently is as follows. Early in February, the court, the High Court Chamber, granted an order placing the Prudential Group under curatorship. That order was subsequently made final, I think, on the 27th of March, and the curators were vested in power in terms of what they can and can't do, should do, rather. We have acted in terms of that court order and have started the process, which is to first of all identify wrongdoing, both the civil and the criminal nature. But more particularly our interest on the civil side in order to recover for the benefit of all the people invested in the Prudential Group. If I may pause for a moment, the application for the place of the Prudential Group under curatorship was resisted to the bitter end, and while the FSB was engaged in investigation, they were frustrated in many ways. In so much so that, in fact, police intervention was required to allow the FSB people access to peace of paper which is engaged in reconciliation. During that process, and from the information that we were, my co-creator and I have been able to gather, it's clear to us that lots of information was subsequently manufactured in order to, in the hope that SSD would go away, or the true picture would not ultimately be presented. The fact of the matter is that it's now quite clear that on an initial calculation of a loss of approximately 689 billion, which was subsequently revised downwards to 409 million, plus minus, that is a loss at the best case scenario. That loss is determined on the basis that assets are inflated and overvalued. And if one takes the reality into account in our respective submission, which we will relate to the court and which we repeat here, that loss is probably more likely in the order of R1 billion. Now, what have we done to that? Those who may have taken office aspirations, and we started to cut costs which were in all the entities which were being run within the group in order to limit the losses. We also tried to make the assets sweat, in the hope that it would enhance value, so when we dispose of these businesses, it would be at fair market value rather than loss-making entity, which would ultimately be beneficial to the beneficiaries, those people being the investors within the financial group. To date, we have not sold a single asset other than the football club for which we realized R2.5 million.
Sorry, Mr. Genoa, if you could speak into the mic, because we are
not sold a single asset other than the Prudential Football Club, for which we realized R2.5 million. We are, of course, in negotiations with several other parties regarding several other assets, and the entire disposal process is under the jurisdiction and control of the SNP, West Prime, or Pollard. So whatever we do, and however we do it, we report to the SNP, we tell them what process we follow. We tell them what numbers on the table, and we make a recommendation one way or the other, and the FSC signs off on it. Notwithstanding the fact that it only sells the Prudential Football Club for about R2.5 million, it's a loss-making entity, and there's litigation involving that because players were suspended, they're not paid for their salaries, and there's later issues, which I don't think I would go on board with. Given the time constraints that we have paid to date about R49 million beneficiaries, simply by making the effort sweat and cutting costs. My colleague George will give you more detail as far as that is concerned. He just saw the numbers stack up, and I'm sure he will be better able than I would be able to give you the exact numbers and how they are calculated. In terms of the legal process, you have seen yesterday morning, for example, we had a bit of misfortune. I put it to higher than that. War terms, it's a skirmish with loss. The battle continues, and as sure as I follow that, we will win that battle. We went to court to claim two houses for the property which was the Brown lives and the adjoining plot, which we intend to develop, I don't know what for, which in our view seems, but I emphasize seems, to have been directly acquired from Tita Money. Directly acquired from Tita Money. And we had an arrangement for the Tita people when they met with us, and with any other investor for that matter, that if we are able to identify a particular asset having been purchased within a particular investor's money, we would, subject to FSC and court approval, want to give the currency for that asset to that particular investor. And we went to court on that basis, yes, we went to court, and the court ruled against us principally on the basis of the doctrine of conversion, which I completely describe as a thief robs you, steals your R1,000, and goes and buys a diamond at the beer at the beers and just in here for R1,000, and by the time the police take the thief and the diamond is now worth R10,000, you can't take either the diamond, you can only take even by R1,000, so the thief can take the property. That's the law of doctrine of conversion, which isn't part of our law. And notwithstanding the fact that our constitution enjoins our courts to develop the common law, we went to court on the basis we said to the court, this R11.5 million stolen from Tita, these properties are worth now R20 million, we want the property. The court view was obviously doctrine conversion was isn't part of our law, wasn't prepared to break with the past and say, well, perhaps it's time to change, and said, sue for the money. So you're we will sue for the money, and we are confident we'll get the 11 miles for him, but Mr. Brown and his family trust will then take the profit. That, as far as that transaction is concerned. Yet, in every other legal action we took, we have proceeded. The Sattis building, for example, in which is the old Dockside Cafe in Wilmington, we successfully brought court court order to claim that property, even though it was rented in the name of the trust. And we could show to the court exactly in the same way as we showed the court in the ground for the houses how the money was applied. We managed to get a court order to give us ownership of the property. That property is going to be used for us. And when I say us, but the Gentry Group, a profit. When I say profit, because of what they paid for it and what they're realizing, a significant sum of money. More than a percentage. I'm obviously cagey about the exact numbers because it's not in the public domain yet. It's subject to approvals and all kinds of other processes. I don't know whether your, Mr. Chairman, whether your procedures have been looked for us to give you information on a confidential basis. I'll be more than willing to give you that information on that basis. I'm just scared that this comes out in the public domain. There's all kinds of difficulties for us and the approaches going forward, which is potentially hampering the disposal process. That's the one building. We also successfully secret placed it with a good check for Stan, who we believe stole about 63 million rand from the Fidation Group as part of the conspirators involved in the demise and collapse of the Fidation Group. Then there's a gentleman who's currently abroad, whose name I would rather not mention. We had negotiations with him, and who is a power of you, the principal protagonist behind this collapse. He's currently what I would call refugee or fugitive from justice. National prosecuting authorities are quite keen to talk to him for reasons completely different to George and I wanting to speak to him. We are due to work with him in the next 2 weeks in the hope that he will be able to extract a significant sum of money which he unlawfully or improperly gained from his own financial collapse. We have advertised over the last couple of months that various businesses are for sale. Many people have displayed an interest, but they get the sense that they think that the fire sale, the bargain hunters are all over the place, and unfortunately there are no bargains to be had. So we are maintaining the businesses in a profitable state, and worst of all, they are just operating at great even points. We're hoping to build them up so we can realize them at the profit for the benefit of the business. Like I said, today we face the stipend stipend. We paid about 49 million rand plus minus without having cut any assets like I said. That's principally from the way we've managed the process. I think I've covered most of it. Any specific to share with any members of the committee, I'd be willing to comment on it. I'm going to draw the answer to what I think.
Thank you, Charlie. Most specific
here,
we have a seaway process that we're probably following at the moment. It's a criminal process which everybody's aware of, and TED forms a substantial focus on that process. Secondly, we are looking to recover the assets for the investors. The fundamental problem we have at the venture is that unlike any, what should happen with investment environment is every investor's fund should be separately demarcated, allocated in books of accounts, and accounted for and recorded as such. That does not happen at the venture. So the main problem we sit with is that all the investors' money is commingled into one pot and then dispersed out of that pot, either lawfully or unlawfully. That will be determined in due course. I think Peter can lay claim to claim to be the founding investor of the venture, and perhaps if it wasn't for Peter, Prudential would have been around, probably would not have been around. CETA itself has invested 197 million rand into you can call Prudential. The investment did not come directly into Prudential's books. It came via an accountant that was incorporated. That is where the money was initially deposited. According to our cash flow analysis, 15 million rand has been paid to CETA. That means approximately 180 million rand as an outstanding capital balance. That's taking, excluding any
gain that could have or should have been made on the investment. It's unlikely that you know, any investor can expect to recover any attributable gain. It's going to be tackled to recover the capital of the investment. So where we are at the moment is that we have, from our side, we have had meetings with all investors, including representatives of the center. We had a meeting earlier in February, you know, where they came to meet us at the offices. We are now in the position where we've done detailed cash flow analyses per investor to try and identify exactly what investors' money is used where. The objective of that exercise is, to the extent possible, notwithstanding the co-mingling of funds, to approach the court where we can identify specific assets purchased with specific investors' cash. We can recover those assets to ask the court that the proceeds of those assets or those assets themselves be given to the specific investor. That exercise in due course, we can only get an indication of how much debt that we expect to recover once we can, we've identified where the money is gone, once we can convert that or recover that. As Dinesh has alluded to, there are certain people that have received substantial amounts of money, including money which we say emanates from CETA, and depending on how successful we are, that can determine how much money they can
thank you. Thank you very much. Let's note people that want to engage with the information. Mr. Trent, you'll be the first. Mr. Harvey, you'll be the second. Mr. Cody, you'll be the third. Thank you, sir. Mr. Trent.
Thank you,
Chair.
Chair, I was very interested to note your comment that if you get this money that this whole business really started to have, that was probably the initial investment in and that you also said that you were investigating some sort of criminal aspect. Could there have been a case of somebody behaving in bribes in CETA in order to make that investment? Because, you know, if that's the case, then certainly that is an issue which by the committee, maybe, whoever it is. Now, that's the first question. And then the other one, you said that we paid $49 million to come in total to beneficiaries. Would that then include the $16 million that you spoke of to CETA, or is that excluding that? Did CETA get any of that $49 million? If not, why not?
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Chair. The answer to the first question is perhaps, let me just take you to what happened. We received the delegation from CETA in the first week of February, about a week or 10 days after the relationship, an uninvited delegation of CETA, about 15 or 16 people with lawyers coming to claim their money, and also supported by the SABC in full coming to collect their money. And they were armed with bank statements to prove that the money was in the bank, etc. Well, at that meeting, the Honourable Dr. Gottwa was part of the delegation, and as always, as George and I had stolen the money, at that meeting, I clearly informed that delegation of two things. That first of all, there was no money in the bank in the order of what they claimed. Secondly, with the statements which we never mentioned seemed on the face of false, falsified, fraud, forgery. And thirdly, that perhaps they would go away and investigate within their own organization how it came about that a nondescript organization called Prudential received the sum of $200 million plus minus from a government agency, how it came about that they would take such an amount, and what is more, that at the time that deposit was made, from our preliminary investigation, bearing in mind this was within a week of us having taken office, the ink on the court order was virtually not even dry yet, that the money was transferred to a so-called asset management company which did not even have a bank account. To add insult to injury, therefore it ended up in the account of a Mr. Maddox, who is an accountant and also director of this, who served the multiplicity of realms. And I said they would please go away and go investigate that, and they would be very surprised as to what they find in the world. At that point in time, I was satisfied in my mind that the chief culprit there was Dr. Bosch, who have taken, who have seen this country, who have seen we are called brothers and sisters, we are privileged here.
No, you have privilege, but we have the media here. So in other words, it might be privileged that you can't be prosecuted, but
okay,
there's no guarantee that you won't be in the on the news at 7 o'clock.
Because I think, thank you. As long as I understand, the question is whether the pleasure number of what might have been prosecuted for one or two things. And that prosecution, in my opinion, stems directly from what we informed the National Prosecution Authorities about, and also from that meeting. But what is critical for that meeting? I said to them what my report was, when I was suspicious, I put cause of suspicion then, because I had to be circumspect. And secondly, we had an undertaking from them that they would provide us with all the relevant documentation that would be relevant for us to investigate that TK investment rather quickly to the benefit of all concerned. And who would you think they were undertaking those investment documents? None other than Dr. Borsa. And as we speak, ladies and gentlemen, Mr. Chair, we're still waiting for it. We haven't received it. So, you can, Mr. Member of the Congress, Mr. Singh, you can draw your own conclusions as to whether it was bribery or not. But if I was a gambler, I would take the bait. George, perhaps you would deal with the question of 49 million.
The 49 million payments is made to the beneficiary. Those beneficiaries are the beneficiaries of the Living Hand Trust, which is respective. The Living Hand Trust, their investment would account for about 80% of the funds invested with the venture. The reason we have paid the widows and orphans, and at the end of June of the 49, we've paid them, I think, at the end of August, in the region of 67, that we were directed to do so by our court order. Apart from the court order, specifically requires us to do that. And then why we don't have to pay for that.
Mr. Kerber?
Chairperson, thank you. I'd like to find out just the exact figures, because we had the we had checked out here again on the 21st of August. And then we were told that the amount that they invested was actually 251 million. And you are mentioning an amount here of 197 million. So can we just get clarity on that before I continue?
Just to clarify, the
251
is actually 2 amounts that were invested, amount of 146 million and 49. That's the amount he's got in our book. The reason that doesn't come to 200 million and 197, as I said, the investments were in the form of promissory notes, which were given to Mr. Maddock, and Mr. Maddock went in cash in prematurely, so the bank kept the balance of the early cash in. And the other 50, we have no records now. All we have is 152, 845, so if there was a further investment that is sitting in Mr. Maddock's book, that has not been brought to account.
Okay, no, we've definitely been told that we are the down and the injury and the transcript is technical. The amount we had originally was 240 bucks, 248, and then it has now been checked, 251 million. So I'm sure there's 50 million rand lying around somewhere, or one was just a clarity. Yeah, the other thing I would like to know is, and we appreciate what you do, really, but you know, being 240 million or 51 million, as we've been told, in taxpayers' money, then obviously you can never ask any questions about it. We'd like to see as soon as possible, as much as possible, being achieved. What we would like to know is do you have any idea, in terms of the time span, how long this debacle will carry on? Because one would not like to see something that will carry on for a couple of years, and at the end of the day, we were also told by Kesa at that meeting of the 21st of August that they were informed by yourself that they're looking at about the retrieval of about 20 to 40 cents in the rand. Now, what I've heard now this morning, is, I just wonder how do they get informed allegedly by yourself? I'll be looking at about 20 to 40 cents in the rand if you are not even far from wrapping it up. And then if I allow me to, I've got one or two others.
Let's deal with those and then we'll allow you to pursue further. If you could deal with those two first.
I'll deal with, thanks Chair, I'll deal with the first question. My question of Tony, Mr. Cameron, let me tell you that when I was specifically invited to make myself available to serve as a curator, and I was told that he would be in the master box and prepare himself for 10 years. Challenge to our authority under which the subpoena people to examine them and to extract documentation from them. The FSB is aware of it and currently in the seriously under review. There's now a court application brought in another matter which deals with constitutional issues around the same issue. And so to some extent we sort of suspended that process except where people are willing to cooperate with us. Now, having told you all that in a long-winded way, the answer is a very simple answer from a timing point of view, Mr. Chairman. My colleague and my wish and desire to file our first liquidation account or distribution account before the end of the year. And during that process, then we hope to make an award. And then, of course, and I think that award will deal with the substantive body of assets which we have under our control. We cannot dictate a timeline in terms of the litigation which is underway. For example, we can go to the ground for the house. I can put assurance as far as they will win that case. It's going to take 2 years before I get to court. That's beyond my control. But by and large, the back of this relationship will be broken, I think, by the middle of next year for the latest. I think we should be able to file a first distribution account by the end of the year. As far as the question of the distribution is concerned and the percentage, my colleague is not able to answer that for you. With your permission, Chair, I would ask George to please give you that answer.
Clarify that question, Mr. Chair. When we got there, the first thing we did is identify what assets essentially we had. And they have essentially the assets categorized in three categories. We have a private equity portfolio, which comprises the underlying trading entity, businesses. There was a property portfolio, and there was supposedly a cash portfolio. It was very easy to determine the cash portfolio because when we got there, there was only 8 million in the bank account, so there wasn't much cash to talk about. So there we arrived at between 20 and 40. It will always be subject to us being able to identify specific assets attaching to specific investments. But on the assumption that we cannot do that because there's been co-mingling of all investment funds, we have revalued the private equity portfolio and we have revalued the property portfolio. And based on our estimation of the cumulative investment by all investors in CEPA and the other investment interventions, cumulative investments are 1.6 billion. Various investors have been repaid 300 million, so we are looking at 1.2 billion rand, which should be represented by it. In our estimation, we estimate to recover approximately 300 million, that will give you a billion rand loss. And you take the 300 million over approximately 1.2. How obviously, if you now recover further funds from people that receive money that either willingly come to retire, then you'll obviously that figure will go up. But that is how we arrive at that initial information. People seem to be in the boardroom. Qualified subject of the aid funding
looks like it's a 25-30% possibility of recovery.
so that we all understand. Because at 180, unless things change like the houses, at best we would get about 30% of that information. Okay, no, that's fine. So I'm raising that so that your members are Christian, that they focus on. If they feel that you must up that, you're not doing enough work, let them say that. If they feel that they're able to live with that, let them say that. But I don't want us just to have a discussion for a discussion's sake. So from a background point of view, scope of members, there's 180 billion rand. Chances are we're going to get 30% of that money, as things stand now. And I'm saying that is how we must focus our discussion. If we think that we should be getting more and the curators are not doing enough, that's indicated. So let's go to Mr. Haber.
And I think we can all focus our own questions, but anyway. I'd like to know, you mentioned, Mr. Diwala, that the only thing you've sold so far was the football club, but you also had an auction and there was sale of equipment that's included in that.
I beg your pardon, you're 100% correct, it slipped my mind. I apologize for the confusion. There were two auctions, the one in Johannesburg, also officer and stuff, and both the vehicles to surface, so I mean, I'm terribly sorry, it slipped my mind, it's an oversight. I apologize.
Okay, now, thank you, we accept that, we all make mistakes. The other thing is, there's 251 million in the toll, taxpayers' money. In your disposal process, what kind of element of transparency do you bring in? Because I mean, then it will become.
What we've done in the proposal is advertise to the national media and all the different parties who want to buy any of their assets to register their interest. We get them to sign the customary documentation in terms of confidentiality and non-disclosure. They then embark on a due diligence process. They then submit an offer. We give them whatever information we can to get the best, as good a price as we possibly can. We then engage with all of them to try and secure the highest purchase price. Then we take it to the FSG and say, this is the process we've followed, this is the price we've got, these are the numbers, this is our recommendation, and the FSG then says yes or no.
No, I continue, Chair. On your letter to Mr. Dixon from the committee secretary, you say here, I attach financial statement which forms part of our report to the FSB, from which it's evident that the duration cost has been saved. I must draw your attention to the fact that these costs include costs incurred by curators such as forensic experts, professional investigations, attorneys, advocates, and the like. Do you have an umbrella organization doing all this stuff, or do you have various lawyers, whatever?
We have principally the arrangement that I use mostly the people within Australia, just because it's convenient, and discounted rates. We're not limited to them, I've used other professional organizations as well. And I think we have several times to the voters.
So I just follow up, to stand back to the discussion that you introduced earlier, our rates that we charge are regulated by the Office of the Auditor.
Chair, I'm nervous. I'm glad. We don't want to. We're thankful for what you do, there's no issue about it. But what we don't like to do, or what we wouldn't want to see, as you've already said, this thing can drag up to 2 years. And we don't want the situation where the cow is being milked. And at the end of the day, it might not be to the best interest of taxpayers. It might be in the interest of taxpayers to say, let's call it a day and liquidate the whole thing and take our losses and walk away. Because I'd like to know from you, since you said that the first thing was done in February, early February, and then it was finalized in March. Now, we are now in September. What is the cost so far for curatorship?
Mr. Haber, I mean, the tower that you're talking about, in light basis, I mean, you do, but the tower is any sacred animal in my religion. When I was asked to get involved in this adventure thing, when I understood what the background was, I actually volunteered to serve in this capacity with no charge. And you're free, and anybody else is free to go and investigate the truth in that matter, in that statement which I made. And I could get publicly in front of the committee, and I believe the media is here. I was in that top of mind with Christ because they said they needed me to commit myself to this process because we're dealing with a difficult bunch of people. And if I had no economic interest in the matter,
by way of being paid, I might simply say, well, it's another job in the team of business. I think because I'd like people to understand the context from where I come into this matter. I would then eventually agree a fee with them, which is way below my normal charge out fee as an attorney, and I've been involved for over 30 years. In the light of the fact that the teacher matter constitutes at least 10% of what we're talking about, I don't think it's appropriate that I tell this committee and the whole world what my charges are. I was quite happy to tell you privately and I'll tell the chair privately, but I don't think it's for me to put my private business on display in a matter which is not under the jurisdiction of this committee.
Just for clarity, another thing,
Mr.
We respect that and the community that is not what we like. We just need to get an indication, if we should be part of a situation which will drag out for another 10 years. But what I'd also like to know, we were also informed by TETA, seeing that we're dealing with TETA here, that they also appointed a legal firm to negotiate with the directors on their behalf. Are you aware of this? And do you think this is a wise decision on them? What do you think it costs you?
That legal team accompanied them with that delegation. As part of that delegation, that came to see me in January or in February. It's very difficult for me to make any comment as to whether it's desirable to have them or not. I'm a professional, I'm a lawyer. I don't want to make any comments in terms of what colleagues should be doing or should not be doing. KETA and their wisdom have decided to engage lawyers. And the KETA people must decide whether they're getting value for their service. And they have their own forensic accountants, and they do all sorts of stuff. They must see whether there's any value for them. It would be impossible, it would be terrible, it would be potentially wrong for me to make any comment on that. I think KETA must decide whether they're getting value for what they engage the professional people for. What I can say, though, that the presence of lawyers here from whatever quarter cannot alter the things we do and cannot accelerate the speed at which we are going already, because if we go any faster, we go through a speed trap and we get locked up. We can't go any faster. We can't do anything any different because we are governed by a court order which dictates what we need to do and the underlying legislation which empowers us. So nobody can tell us change is the change there. So it's nice if we'd like to do things a lot faster, like I said earlier on. We have this handicap in terms of what the court order is. There's still challenges to be. There's nothing we can do, unfortunately. I mean, we've got to
just follow up on the question. I do just see that you have a potential issue concept of liquidation in health and nutrition. I think my comment to that is I don't think a liquidation would have yielded the results that you've yielded so far. I definitely don't think a liquidation would mention that.
I think that, Cameron, before you go on, let's start from Mr. Becker. Do you have any questions that you're going to say?
No, nothing.
Thank you. Mr. Corner?
Just quickly, we're talking about data recovery for money, and you said you sold Soccer Club, you had auctions, and you alluded to the other money. And then you, when you came to the Mr. Brown's property and the adjacent property, the value you mentioned, is that a market value? Or what is that? Because it's in Sunset Beach, it's quite a market up area. I don't know the property size, so it seems to be off the cuff quite a low value attached to that. But now you say you're going to sue for that money, but the court might take a long time to do that. And Mr. Brown's property and the adjacent property directly linked to TETA money being invested. So, first of all, what is the absolute value of those properties? And secondly, I hear what you say, you cannot speed up the process, but if you want to sue for the money, why does it take 2 years for it to get closure on those two properties?
The court of the answer is going to follow immediately. Get up and... So the process we followed by the court procedure was to acquire the property so that TETA could get the benefit of the capital growth. because we were hit by the doctrine of conversion, which I explained earlier on, so basically get 11.5 million back. We tried to get 6.5, we tried to make a promise on those investments to the benefit of CETA. But therefore now we have to sue. Now we have to sue for 11.5 million. But if you don't get to sue for 11.5 million, someone called me a Rockwiler once, that's a thousand people. We're going to sue now for the property still, and in the alternative for 11.5 million. And if the next court decides that there's something that isn't time for the doctrine of conversion to be challenged in this country, to be introduced in this country. Now, in terms of the timeline, we'll issue summons, we'll file the pleadings, the lawyers on the committee, then pleadings, the exchange, and then we'll wait for the trial date. And as you know, the court's quite inundated with work. So the earliest trial date I think we will get is probably early in 2009. I don't want to say June next year, and then I'm Mr. Hammer's going to ask me to say June last year. And then I'm in the spot, and I'm going to apologize again.
Mr. Hammer, is it? If you have one more, Mr. Hammer, fine. You're going to go right around and take it from there.
I find it difficult to accept that situation quite beyond the control. He's taking the place for us. And that we can't get it earlier than 2009 without committing yourself to an earlier date. But the fact is, he just doesn't make sense.
Mr. Chair, I answer this with respect, Mr. Kuhlman. The legal process, there are pleadings to be exchanged, there are time frames. Therefore, the ground is in the habit of delaying that. You will fight with him to get him to open the door. You will fight with him because he doesn't do anything. You will fight with him every inch of the way. Despite these public utterances that he wants to cooperate, he frustrates us every inch of the way. So, from a data issue summons until the pleadings are closed, will take roughly 3 months. That's working at top speed. Depending on, because you've got so many days to go to the court rules which you have to comply with. Then we have to apply for a date of a continuous court hold. The 100% of the litigants will make these dates as well. We will stand in the queue behind the scenes. And then the court, the registrar allocates the date. And if I anticipate that date to be in January 2009, maybe a miracle day comes towards the middle of our next year, I don't know. Rather stay on the side of caution for the reasons I've just told you.
I think the point the committee is making is that right to hear that if at all can be accelerated, it would make us feel much happier. But I think that's the point. We're not going to discuss whether it's possible or not. But for us, the sooner it's done, the better, I think, is what we are saying.
We give the committee an unequivocal undertaking that we will run this curatorship process as fast and as effective and efficiently as we can, to make sure that people who are invested in this organization are repaid as quickly as possible.
Mr. Chen?
Yes, this is for on the 25 to 30 cents, that now excludes the possibility of you being able to link specific assets to CETA. So what I'm really saying is that if you are able to do that, as in the case that the Kurloff is talking about, then maybe CETA would get additional funds. You know, you start with the mingling of that, if you're able to unbundle some of those things, it might be easier then be in a position to use a little more.
Yes?
Yeah. Mr. Chairman, it actually cuts both ways. People may use it at least. Because you see, we can track individual assets that we can come into. Sorry, the houses belong to you, but Sunday wine farm, not one link of your money was passed to buy that, so you can sell it for X. You can't share that. That cuts both ways. We say on the principle of co-mingling, look at 25%. If we can file a distribution account to the court, that the individual assets may be more, maybe less, but some investment, maybe that's what it is.
Mr. Gordy, Mr. Schentz.
Do you want to say something, Mr. Senior?
You're right. You're fine. What? You're fine. Mr. Gordy?
Just two questions to clarify. The letter that is sent to us, and it's four. And Mayor Shakta Kamp, the last indication, 27 June 2007, is a non-reply. Is it possible to find out, to clarify that? And on the subsequent paragraph, apply as follows, the last one, 28, to place 5 cents.
Possible to translate that? Yes.
charges, those relate to payments that were taken as proceeds given for the payment of the parties with a corporate. That deposit the proceeds from the sale of the auction.
The unknown reference?
That's the unknown reference of 135 euros.
Have we over the last
night? Sure, no, I just want to find out something also based on the documents that you've given us. And these include various fees. I don't know if yours are included in it, we don't want to talk about that, but there's more than 4 million rand of fees here. The figures we have here is for the end of June. Now, your curatorship started early February and it was finalized in March, so we're talking about 4 months. Now, in other words, it's about 1 million rand a month. What is, I mean, as a layman, in figures here that we have to dissect and see what it is, could you just give me some clarity?
Let me give you an example, Mr. Here is the total sequestration of the subscription. Let's take the last question. That is put together an application for legally being selling 65 million rand from the proposed application. Two advocates, Cape Town Jams, were applying, being forced to propose application. That's a couple of 100,000 rand. If you will recover, you call it an estate. Because you've got a cost, you want the application to this cost. So, in that, you've got advocate fees, two salt, a salt and a junior, Cape Town Base, and a Cape Town Base salt and a junior in Johannesburg. That's just one example. Then in the other court application that we're doing, we're using a service and advocate on an ongoing basis, so those costs of 4 million rand isn't representative of your status. Although we are included in that. In ordinary language, I think the prudential creditors are getting a bargain. It could be far worse. How we invite members of this committee to compare this income and expenditure account with other curatorships which may have happened in the past and see what they've achieved after 5 months and see what they have charged. But we charge criminally in the legal profession. For
undercut.
That's why I don't
tell you
what I'm
asking. All right. I think what we are saying from this meeting, one, is that for us, the acceleration of this exercise, as far as is humanly possible, is something that we dearly appreciate. We'd also keep a BDI, that curatorship cost, whatever you want to call it, kept to a minimum. We hear you saying that you'd be charged for undercharging. And of course, ultimately, that we maximize the recovery to beneficiaries generally, but specifically to teachers, because that's our responsibility. But we welcome, just generally, that all the beneficiaries, certainly living hands, trust in those people, that they get, if 30 cents in the rand is the most they can get, then it must be because we have we've cut all the unnecessary fats, be it legal fees, be it time frames, and so on. I think that's what we're saying. And again, from our point of view, we certainly will be close to or on top of this matter for as long as it lasts, because it's in our interest. And I think that is the message that we're sending to you, sir. And of course, I'm sure through the chair, on a regular basis, we'll interact with yourself if there ever is a need to interact with the gentleman to keep on top of what's happening. And I want to thank you for availing yourself to this hearing. Certainly not the last, but it assists us in our own ongoing oversight and our work. I think that's what I wanted to say. I'm not sure. Close it. I'm saying that you let these people, these people that remain behind us, I don't know if there's anything else you have to say to the curator.
Yeah, no, I think I need to also clarify and assess the thing that our intention to engage with them for them to the purpose of getting information. And I think as a process has turned out to be equally as clear that a lot of full or both people's quality has been somebody coming to the public funds that
thank you very much for having us this morning. I'd like to emphasize what is the thing. To have our unequivocal commitment, like I say, to speed up this process, to do it as fast as we can and as cost efficiently as we possibly can. And in the last comment that Comrade Bodie made, I just want to re-emphasize that South Africans. And what I said earlier in terms of my own position was I was driven by the process of seeing the stars and widows and orphans going short every month. And that's in the forefront of my day-to-day existence. And whilst I must admit that they are probably a greater concern to me than Peter, if I stand any differently with the ones, but the truth of that is because of my concern, our concern for them, Peter is also going to benefit from the process because we can't discriminate. And we are committed to deliver this process as fast as possible. And in the end, the only benefit that I and my partner from this is this exercise to gain, if we can collect all the benefits, is the reputation that we will receive for having done the job, as well as it possibly would in the shortest space of time. As far as the members of this committee are concerned, you are all free, collectively or individually, to at any time phone me. My telephone number is available, Mr. Dixon has it, and to ask any information about any process related to the potential matter, because it indirectly impacts on CETA. And provided you are reasonable in your request and in timeline, I will give you that information. There are no secrets here because we have to report to the court. And we sit around this table. There's a common purpose here. You are worried about CETA. We are worried about CETA plus 60,000 other people. And we want to make sure that this kind of fraud and theft and looting does not repeat itself in the classical financial services industry. It's not only bad for us people, it's bad for the country. It paints a negative image internationally in terms of our governance issues. And I'm personally committed to do my bit to clean it up as best I can.
Thank you, sir. That's the end of the meeting. If members of SOFA, as usual, could stay behind us, that we can do some wrap-up of our business. But thank you, to the curators and to all our other visitors. Thank you very much.
Grab your tea and listen to our evaluation if you want. There is tea outside. Ma'am? No. The next one is an evaluation.
Can I announce today for this?
No, I can't have a finish before.
No, we're not. We're just going to do the normal evaluation and see. 5 minutes.
Can we